Sexton trying to get loose. He'll fire.
He knocks it down.
But Carl slammed it home. Garland upstairs.
Oh!
Sexton is fine. A thunderous dunk.
And Allen blocked the shot at the rim.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, part of the Cavs Media Family. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. With me today is my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Justin. It was not the most fun game I've ever watched last night. But we have survived the West Coast trip and are greeted with the Philadelphia 76ers. Thanks. Schedule. Jesus.
Yeah, well, you know, nice chance to get back on track with the Sixers, Miami Heat, Spurs, next three games.
Some real winnable games there on the on the slate.
Well, I think it's important for us to point out, Carter, and we do have a very special guest today, but Kyle Newbeck is here of the Philly Voice. And Kyle, I have a really important question for you. Are the Cavs going to sweep the season series against the Sixers?
I am betting that the Sixers are hoping that doesn't happen. it's a really weird thing. I feel like there have been some great Sixers-Cavs games in recent years, you know, especially I think Sixers fans like to remember the peaks when they were beating the LeBron era teams.
Yeah, I recall the overtime game in 2018 very specifically.
That was a very good one.
I believe the game was that the Sixers were absolutely murdering the Cavs. LeBron went nuts, huge comeback, and then you guys iced it in OT. And that was one of the very few fun games of the 2018 era.
Yeah, that sounds about right, because if the Sixers were up by a lot and blew the lead at halftime, that was basically every Sixers game for, you know, about 3 years there. So that's very on brand for this group.
Going through team building is a lot of fun. and even once you start to get up the hill, there's still so many obstacles you need to overcome. For whatever reason, it seems like the Cavs have managed to steal a game each year against the Sixers. Like, I think this year and last year, they somehow won back-to-back games against the Sixers and Rockets. Now, that was more impressive when they did it last year. But this year, it's certainly been a surprise. I think the Cavs are probably a little fortunate that they never got to experience the Drummond and Embiid matchup, because that historically...
Oh, yeah.
Has not gone in the favor of Andre Drummond. But Kyle, could you provide some insight on exactly kind of what's gone on in those two games? Is it a matter of the Sixers kind of playing down to the competition? Or, I mean, obviously Embiid wasn't there for the first game, but it's still surprising that we're going into game three with a 2-0 record against Philly.
Yeah, I think the first game, I would chalk a lot of it up to being about Embiid's absence, because up until about the last week or two, they were basically a terrible basketball team whenever Joel sat. And that's not just this season. That was his whole career up to this point. From 2016 onward, the Sixers lose him, and then they're just like a ship lost at sea somewhere. But the other game, I think, was closer to, you know, the Cavs did some things to bother them. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, I think Ben Simmons had something like 7 turnovers or 8 turnovers in that game. So, you know, some of that's on Ben. Some of that is on Cleveland making the right reads and jumping passing lanes and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's a combination of factors. I do think historically teams with good backcourts, even if they're young, developing backcourts, have given them trouble. It's a lot of, you know, they have 2 off the dribble shooters in Cleveland that can hurt them. So I'm sure that had something to do with it. But, you know, it's the NBA. There are weird quirks like this every year. Sometimes we get to the playoffs and, you know, we look on paper and says, oh, this team was 3-1 against these guys in the regular season. They're definitely going to roll over them. And then the opposite happens. And it just turns out that, you know, there's a convergence of factors happening there.
Yeah,
I do think Sexton in particular plays with a lot of relish against the Sixers. I mean, yeah. Zach Lowe often references that end of season game at the end of Sexton's rookie year where he was going through a pretty terrible run. The team was in pretty tough shape, and Sexton kind of was fearlessly going at, you know, this behemoth Sixers team. So, yeah, I don't know what it is about this matchup, but it's one that I don't. You know, I mean, this season is, you know, they've taken their fair share of L's. I think six losses by 30 or more, which is oof. Yeah. Actually, no, that's six by 20
That's
or
a
more.
Big old oof.
Actually, I can't remember. Either one. either way, it's not a good number. But, you know, for whatever reason, with Philly, it's not a team that I go, oh, man, we're in for a rough one. And it really should be based on the season they're having.
You know, now that you mention it too, bringing up Sexton's name, I think like just the way he's wired. I know even going back to college, he's, you know, hyper competitive guy and all the superlatives you could say about somebody's character. Mm-hmm. And so when you combine that with a Sixers team that, you know, they're a little bit further in their development, they feel themselves a little bit like they've been all-stars, all NBA. They're in, you know, year-end award type talk. So they go into a game against, they look down on, it's not just like a team below them in the standings, but it's like a young team that maybe we can just show up tonight. But Colin Sexton, generally speaking, is not the type of guy that you just can roll it out there and he's going to like lie down for you. Like I think when right after Brooklyn made the James Harden trade, they found that out the hard way. Like they were still figuring things out and Colin Sexton had a ridiculous night against them.
Yeah, and it's funny. I think it was a Cavs Twitter friend of ours. I think it was Ziggy that tweeted that professional teams just kill the Cavs right now. Like, if you show up and you execute really, really well, then the Cavs kind of just don't have the horses to keep up. But, like, that's kind of where they've thrived this season overall is, you know, when teams aren't giving their A effort, the Cavs are able to stay in games. And sometimes they can kind of set that tone. And they are so relentless because if there is one good thing about this Cavs team, it's that when they're playing well, they're playing pretty well. And if you let them get going, then you're in for a game. I mean, the problem is when they're not playing well, they really can't dig themselves out. That's why they're losing all these games by double digits and more. I guess not more than double digits.
Yeah. That would be really impressive.
That would be hard on the spirit.
How Twitter acts after a lot of Cavs losses these days. And that's part of why I value having you here, Kyle, and kind of bring in some outside perspective. Because right now it does feel like things are a little bleaker than they need to be. For whatever reason, it feels like...
Oh, dude, you're talking to somebody who deals with a fan base where the running bit on Twitter is that they could be up by 15 at halftime and half the fan base is miserable. And if you just read people's tweets, you would think it was the opposite, that they're down 15. So I totally get it.
Yeah. It's the beauty of markets that are passionate about sports, that love absolutely their teams. Like it's something that happens.
And a little bit of a victim complex.
maybe just a hair of that.
Just
a
smidge. I don't shoot the messenger.
we have a lot this of people. Go ahead.
Last night I went to sleep and I was just like, Justin can confirm. I was messaging him. I was really down in the dumps. And I had just been working a really long work week and I was just overtired and pissy. Then I got like 10 hours of sleep last night. I woke up. I had all the context in the world. I was as zen as could be. I'm like, is how I feel about this team exclusively based on how tired I am on a given on a given day? Because I really think that's 90% of what most people are. It's just like whatever your state is what you project onto the team.
Yeah.
Because this morning I've been all optimism, baby.
And plus, we're all kind of in a more vulnerable state right now because the last year has been a little tough and this season is tough. And I was rolling my eyes a little bit this morning too, just wrong side of the bed type stuff. But looking at so many people that predicted 15 wins that are now saying, well, this team should be a lot better than they are right now. Well, they have 17. Like this is what did you expect? You can't move the goalposts like that. But Kyle, you mentioned obviously Sexton playing well against Philly. Some of the turnovers the Cavs have been able to generate in those matchups. Has there been anything else in those games that have stood out to you from a Cavs perspective?
Well, I really think that the way that they've played Simmons has been great. Like, I think that's a standout thing because I believe both games he was pretty poor. And, you know, some of that was Ben started the season in a bad funk, but mm-hmm. you know, they played them a little bit later on and sort of the same story. Like they decided, look, we can protect the rim. We can, like, I believe they had Jared Allen for the second game that they played, if I remember correctly.
They did, because he had a couple of the most ill-fated post of attempts on Joel that I've ever seen in my life.
Well, listen, yeah, look, when he's going up against Joel, he's actually done a decent job over his career, generally speaking, against Joel, but I think that game in particular, Joel was on kind of a mission.
13 foot post up attempts. maybe leave those in the bag next time.
Yeah.
But so they trust their rim protectors back there. And so other than that, they're playing passing lanes and they're saying, look, if Ben Simmons can go out there and he can score 25 points against us or 30 points, that's a big rarity for him, then fine, we'll live with that. But we're going to take away his advantages as a passer and as a playmaker. And, you know, a lot of teams attempt to do that. There's a lot of like shrink the court and like try to turn him into a scorer, but not everybody is effective at it because he can hit guys from all angles. So I was impressed from that standpoint. I'm just impressed. Like every time I've seen them, I haven't watched the Cavs a ton this year, but whenever I've seen them, it's a very professional effort. As you guys have said, when teams open windows for them, they generally walk through them or go through them and they take that opportunity. And that to me is a good sign for a young team. Like I always used to think the idea of, you know, the teams learning how to win is kind of this hokey BS concept. And then I see the Sixers over the years, like they very much went through that arc where, you know, they were winning a lot of games, but there were games they could have put away way earlier or games they should have won, but ended up losing. Whereas this year, it's just professional effort after professional effort after professional effort. And they've built these reps over time where now they figure that out. So, you know, I'm not saying that Sexton and Garland are Embiid and Simmons or anything, but you know, you can see, you can see positive developments, and it's like they're on the right track for where they're at in their careers, I think.
What do you think of the Cavs backcourt? Because obviously it's something that gets discussed a lot with both point guards being under 6'2". There's obviously examples of that working with other teams, but it's always dependent on kind of the team context, the support structures they put around them. Do you think that this is a backcourt that could work in the future, or are you kind of on the wait and see side of things?
I would say I'm on the wait and see side of things, but I will admit, like in their first years, I didn't see it that much with them. And then both guys have taken very noticeable leaps forward. I think, you know, a lot of that is just their shooters now. Like if both of those guys are, you know, they don't have to be elite shooters necessarily, but if they're high level shooters, especially off the dribble where you can put pressure on teams as pick and roll players, like they're not wing size players like, you know, a team like the Celtics have, but it's a very powerful thing when, you know, if you have a ball handler and an opposing team puts their best perimeter defender on that guy and you can give it to another ball handler and say, look, we trust you, maybe not more than this guy, but at least as much as that guy to go out and get a bucket or create for teammates. I think that's always, you know, the game's going to change many times over between now and when we're, you know, old and in our rocking chairs still watching basketball. But I think anytime you can create mismatches and put pressure on people off the dribble, that I think that's always going to be valuable. So they're going to need some help. I think when you have a small backcourt like that, you really need to load up on, you know, athletic defenders, rim protectors, so on and so forth. And those are guys that tend to get paid a lot of money or go high in the draft. So it'll be tough, but you know, I think it's probably doable.
It's funny that you say that, because in a lot of ways, and I don't know if most non-Cavs, you know, diehards or, you know, people who watch a lot of the team notice this, but for me, I actually notice more needs on the offensive end of the ball than the defensive end of the ball at this point, because they've really started to build the right infrastructure. They're still too young, so they're still they're not going to be a good defensive team with a core of 22-year-olds. You know, we know that.
Yeah.
But you know, with archetypally Isaac Okoro, Larry Nance, Jared Allen is kind of the perfect front court to pair with those guys, and you know, there's always going to be a defensive ceiling that is going to be hard to hit with two guys with their frames and their sizes. But offensively, I feel like that's actually the one where I'm seeing like, man, is this team dying for a big wing that can handle the ball a little bit and kind of beat these teams that really can just throw oversized wings at Sexton and Garland and trap them and make the floor, you know, hard to see. That's where they really are missing that connective tissue right now. Justin just prefers to boil it down to front court scoring so he can just say it'll all be fixed when Kevin Love comes back. But I do think there is some ball. I think their size is actually a little limiting on the other side of the ball.
I can also pivot and say it's a home court thing, because I just tweeted this out before we started podcasting, but their O rating at home is 109.3 and on the road it's 98.6. That's you're not going
Kyle, let me just tell you something. This team's road splits, just take 5 minutes and go look them up.
I'm sure they're comical. Well, that actually reminds me, you guys know Matisse Thybulle, Philadelphia's
of course.
Mm-hmm. Wing, second year player. I believe last year, I think his shooting splits from three, I think at home he was in the low 40s and then he was in the high 20s on the road. So that was like, man, this guy goes from being like Ray Allen to me out there, essentially.
Yeah, that's Okoro. I think he's shooting 39% from three at home and like 11% on the road. It's just absurd. Like, it up and down the roster, that seems to be the case. And I mean, we've highlighted some of the stuff before. They've talked about not having shoot-arounds, all the COVID protocols on the road. You're not comfortable. This is a young team. Those teams typically play better at home. So there's a lot of factors there. But
for those that don't know, the Cavs have a minus 2.9 net rating at home, okay? 2.9. On the road, they are, oh my God, can you please update? Minus 13.3.
Ooh, man, that's tough.
I don't know if there has ever been a 10-point net rating swing from home games to road games.
Yeah, that's just absurd. And man, like, I don't want to dive too much into a game preview because we're in a situation where Jared Allen's been out with a concussion. Hopefully he can come back. Larry Nance
has been
out,
sick.
Yeah, Larry Nance out with this illness, not COVID related, so that's good, because obviously you don't want him dealing with that, especially with some of the immune issues that he has. But I do want to kind of pivot a little bit to Philly, because I find Philly to be really interesting. You had mentioned that they're a little further along the team building path
for
than
sure.
The Cavs.
Yeah. Just a smidge.
This was a team that I slapped some money on to make the finals before the season. So I think that it's fair to say that they're kind of a little further along the developmental curve. But I'm curious, now that the trade deadline has passed and kind of the dust has settled with a lot of the buyout market guys, of the contenders and fringe contenders, which teams, Philly included, if you want to include them, have improved in a way that matters?
So, I mean, I still think Brooklyn is it's like the boring answer. I think Brooklyn is the alpha dog with, you know,
really?
They have Durant and Harden. And
I think
Irving.
It's wild that anyone doesn't, Kyle.
Yeah, I just look, I ultimately, and I said this before they got Harden, I watched them on opening night and you watched Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant. And anytime you have two guys who are just absolute nails as scorers, mm-hmm. and can create a shot whenever they want, who can hit shots with hands in their faces, like, yeah, I know the defense is pretty mystifying at times, but, you know, I just, you add James Harden to that mix and I just don't see how teams guard them. Now, on the flip side of that is, I think the Sixers probably match up well with them comparatively to, like, not just the rest of the East, but the rest of the league, because they cannot guard Joel Embiid. There is no mm-hmm. chance they can stop him in a series. And so then it just becomes like, okay, if Ben Simmons can at least slow down one of their perimeter guys, he's just like, obviously he's not going to stop all three. If
Matisse who do you want to put Simmons on?
I believe I wrote a preview before the last game. I think I would put in on Harden, because Harden has been the creative engine behind that team. And, you know, I think with Kevin Durant, if you put Simmons on him, there's a chance that he just hits every shot anyway. Like, it might not matter.
You're taking the words out of my mouth. That is exactly the kind of game plan that I would anticipate, or the one that I would recommend.
You hope that someone like Matisse can stay on the floor enough, right? Just to get under him, use his fast hands and bother him before the shot is up in the air, right?
Yeah,
and before he's up in his form.
I think with Harden, Ben can just stop him from creating as much dribble penetration as he needs to. And even if he does, I think they trust Joel back there to clean it up and protect the rim and what have you. And so then you just start like, look, if Kevin Durant shoots you out of a series, what are you going to do? The guy's an all-time great Hall of Fame, future Hall of Fame player, whatever. But if James Harden is getting into the paint and sucking everybody in and creating open three after open three after open three for other players, I think that's where you get into the danger zone with them. So mm-hmm. that's how I would play it. But I still think Brooklyn out of the East as the favorite. Like, I don't believe, I was a bigger Bucks believer before, you know, last year's meltdown. Maybe they're a little better this year with Drew Holiday. And well, I don't know if Budenholzer finally learned his lessons. Or
I like to point out that you go back a couple of years. Now, assuming the Warriors still have the same injuries, like game three, up 2-0 against Toronto. If Giannis gets a single free throw in regulation, they probably win a championship if the Warriors have the same injuries. And obviously last year's meltdown was ugly. I'm assuming Jeff Teague doesn't do a whole lot for you the same way he doesn't do a for us. No. and you know what? Maybe there's some bias kicking in here because we were talking about the Nets, and that's the other team that is winless against the Cavs this season. So maybe that's coloring my view a little bit. But I have legitimate concerns about KD's health, like being able to stay healthy for a full playoff run.
Which is fair.
Yeah,
for sure.
When he's missed this much time. And even I just think from a continuity standpoint, it's going to be difficult if he does come back with like a month left before the playoffs. It just feels like one of those situations where they're going to be a nightmare next season, but it might take a year, similar to what happened with Miami. And personally, I just don't really like what they did with the buyout options. Like I understand going for those guys. And I think maybe Blake has a little bit more potential to help them out because he's a playmaker and can do other things. Yeah. But LaMarcus, if you're playing him, like I don't know if you should be playing over Claxton. And this might be a hipster and NBA Twitter type
this
thing.
This is such a hipster take.
I think it is a hipster take, but he sucks. I don't think there's much juice left there, man.
I think I get your point. I think Nash is a really capable coach and personality manager where, you know, I think he has legit clout in that locker room to make the right decisions. I mean, Claxton's been eating up more and more minutes anyway, no matter what they've been doing. So I just feel like it's another bolt in the chamber because like ultimately, like we have not seen a guy like Nick Claxton in the playoffs yet. Like those are the kind of players who look nice and then someone schemes them out of a series.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, I'm not saying that's going to happen to him, but that happens to young players all the time. And it's not there's no slander in saying that. So I don't know, man. I just think you look at the overall talent level and it doesn't appear to be super close compared to the rest of the East. And my question, Kyle, is about the you know, a deal that Philly didn't make, which was cashing in some assets and going and getting Kyle Lowry. How did you feel about that at the time? How do you feel about it now with a little bit of hindsight?
So I was generally speaking an advocate for them trading for Lowry because, you know, I look at Joel Embiid. This is the best he's ever been. He obviously hurt right now. I think he's going to return right after you guys will miss him. So that's lucky break for your boys in Cleveland.
Well, boy, could we use some.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I think you look at the landscape and you say, like, Joel Embiid's on an MVP type track this year. Tobias Harris now at like he didn't make the All-Star team, but I think he's been at an All-Star level.
Yeah.
Ben Simmons is at a Defensive Player of the Year type level. The offense is still like up and down for him as it's been throughout his career, but you know, he's a very valuable guy. So you look at that and they still need, or they still feel like they need another ball handler, like a legit ball handler for if and when there are issues related to Simmons's offense in the playoffs. Because, you know, we mentioned other guys who run into walls in the playoffs or might run into pitfalls. He's had some spectacular failures on the big stage to the point where when they were there 2 years ago with Jimmy Butler basically just took the ball and Ben stood in the dunker spot and didn't really do anything on offense. Now, granted, he's checking Kawhi on the other end, so that's the lion's share of his work. But, you know, it's still not ideal that your quote unquote point guard is basically a non-entity on offense. So I was in favor of the Lowry move, but I will say, based on my reporting and what other people I trust have reported and said over the last, you know, week, 2 weeks, the price just got so far up there that I don't think that they could do it without feeling somewhat bad about it. I think this is a team that's conscious of the fact that, you know, that was a 35-year-old guy. Like, they're trading for a guy in his mid-30s, whereas, you know, Bradley Beal might become available at some point, and they're going to want to have, I don't know if it's Bradley Beal. It could be anybody. Like, it could be Zach LaVine if this thing with Vucevic doesn't work out.
You want to keep the powder dry, right?
Right. And they want somebody, like, if they're going to cash in a lot of their chips, and that's picks, that's young players, because the offer that was reported was Matisse Thybulle and Tyrese Maxey and 2 first-round picks. And they would have had to give up salary, which in this case would have meant they got to trade Danny Green, who has been on like every team he's ever been on. He's an important defensive piece. He's a guy who, in a post-up centric offense, he's been great as that weak side release valve in the corner.
He's been playing way better lately. Like he's been really awesome.
I'll be holding Danny Green stock when he's 38, 40
you,
years
you and Dave
old.
Dufour. You and Dave Dufour.
Me and Dufour love Danny Green more than anyone else.
Listen, I've been banging this drum all year, but having a guy like him that is not afraid to take a shot at any moment, he doesn't care who's in his face. Like, ball comes to him, he's locked and loaded, ready to go. I've seen a difference between, like, Seth Curry, who's on the Sixers. Great, great shooter. Like, one of the best shooters in the entire league. But there are possessions where he has an openish look and he hesitates. Mm-hmm. That never happens with Danny. And he's like, he's been through all these battles. There's no moment that's too big for him. He's a great locker room guy, great off-ball defender. Like, losing him on top of all the future stuff would have been a huge deal for this team. So I get why they didn't trade for Lowry.
Yeah, and what is interesting about that is, because I thought the Heat trade sans Hero was the poo-poo platter of all poo-poo platters, like Duncan Robinson,
Precious, and a
free agent, a rookie who hasn't done anything yet, and then some vets for salary. And I thought, okay, you know, Masai shouldn't just give Kyle Lowry away for anything. But, you know, I did think, like, Tyrese Maxey matching salary in a first seemed like a lot. I kind of was surprised that it became pretty clear to me, at least, that Masai was looking for a godfather offer, and you just weren't going to get that for a 35-year-old.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, yes, Kelly
Olynyk.
Like, Kelly Olynyk, you would probably need to be moved to make the salary work. And yes, he was the best player that came back in the James Harden trade at this point. But still, like,
Jared Allen was the best player that got moved in the James Harden trade.
I meant went to Houston, but very good correction. But Kyle, do you think the leaking that Kyle Lowry was interested in kind of negotiating an extension had any impact on his trade value? Because on the one hand, like, it would be assumed that you're bringing in Kyle Lowry with some assumption that he'd be there beyond the season, especially if your team like Philly or Miami, who figures to be in that contending conversation for at least the next couple of years. But at the same time, when you have someone that's 5'11", 35 years old, has had injury issues in the past, maybe like actually seeing like the 2 years, 50 mil or whatever was reported out there, do you think that had any impact on how much they were willing to pay?
Maybe a little bit, but even before like Lowry was quote unquote available, I was hearing stuff from, you know, within the Sixers and outside the Sixers that they just didn't want to make any kind of, unless there was like a true blue chip, like youngish star on the market, which for all intents and purposes, I don't think anybody near that level was there. Like, I would say Lowry is a star, like he's probably a star, maybe like an aging star, but still a star, but they were not going to pay full sticker price for a guy like that. Like, he's too old and he's got all kinds of miles. Like, there are too many risks they were taking there. If they had been able to get a 27, 28 year old version of Lowry, like that type of impact, I think they would have made that deal. Like, I think the Sixers really wanted to make the James Harden deal. They've really pushed for that. I don't think Houston wanted to make a deal with the Sixers. I think that was ultimately,
or more specifically, with Daryl Morey.
With Daryl Morey, yeah, that was. There's some bad blood there, as yeah, you know, I'm sure a few people listen to this now.
I got to ask. They did end up trading for George Hill, and I'm just kind of wondering, when it's not cutting time in the postseason, you know, who should be the closing five for this team?
I've actually been saying, you know, I haven't seen George Hill play for the Sixers yet, but and Seth Curry has been great. I sort of feel like he's going to bump Seth Curry out of the lineup, and they're going to roll George Hill, Danny Green, Simmons, Harris, Embiid.
God, because, that's a hell of a defensive lineup.
It's a great defensive lineup. You have a bunch of shooters on the floor. Like, George Hill might be the worst offensive player in that group.
He can hit open threes with the best of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think he was the best three-point shooter in the entire league last year, efficiency-wise. He shot like 46% from three or something ridiculous. So
yeah, if you watch him, take someone they're open, though. Like,
yeah.
Seth is a little hesitant, he is. And he should be hesitant because he does not – like, he's been a former Cav because he is not someone who shoots well – through a contest. At least the eye test tells me that. Do not go look up those numbers and prove me wrong. But like,
I'm not even going to buy it. It's not on a live, not on a live podcast.
Don't do me like that.
No, not after the fact, nothing. We don't want accountability here. That's the absolute last thing we want.
Please no. But yeah, so like, yeah, I mean, if he is the worst offensive player on the court, but he is, you know, weak side corner, just cashing wide open threes. I mean, there are much worse places to be.
Yeah, I just think I've seen Seth Curry in some recent games against good teams just get picked on a bit defensively. And that was a concern I had coming into the year. I actually think with the assistant coach they have, Dan Burke, who's basically their defensive coordinator, they brought him over from Indiana in the offseason. He's done a tremendous job getting, you know, career best efforts out of pretty much everybody on defense. So he's been able to mask guys who have been, you know, bad defenders in the past, or there have been a lot of overachievers, but I'm still dubious that a few of these guys are going to be, you know, ultimately playable in big spots. And I think Seth is the most important one because he's been the most critical, one of the most critical pieces to building the offense around Ben and Joel.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also has a little bit more off the dribble juice than I think people.
Yeah.
Are aware of with him. They see just a shooter. And I feel like that was one of the big appeals of Kyle Lowry to me, was that you have a pick and roll initiator, or at the very least a secondary initiator once the defense is off balance. And I don't think George Hill adds a lot of that at this point in his career, but so that's, I think that's the kind of calculus you're going to have to make if you're that coaching staff, which is, do I want the uber elite three-point shooting, or do I want the defensive versatility? Because there is a little bit of give and take there.
Yeah, and I think George Hill's length really factors in as well. Like, we saw even in recent games, like, I've watched a fair amount of the Raptors, but against the Cavs, like, it is clear that Lowry's kind of lost a bit of a step defensively, and he made up for that in the past with really quick feet, with being a very physical defender. But the ease at which, like, someone like Darius Garland was able to get by him, like, that started to stand out to me. And especially when you're kind of planning for the future and you have a finite amount of assets in the cupboard, I kind of understand where Philly's coming from, not wanting to go all in on that, even though like, in my opinion, this is a very, very good chance for them to contend for a championship this season.
Yeah, and I think to your point, like, the devil's advocate on that point is, like, you know, maybe he has lost a step and maybe he can't recover the way he used to, but they have Joel Embiid.
There are a lot of safety nets.
So, like, he is the walking safety net for them. And then on top of that, if for whatever reason you have a bad matchup at point guard, Ben Simmons has shown, look, I'll just switch on to the point guard. And, you know, that's not always the solution. And to get to the finals, you're going to have to play teams like Brooklyn that you're not going to be able to just stick guys in the corner and hide them somewhere. The worst guy might be like Joe Harris, who's going to come off screens and just absolutely punish you if you're not diligent navigating through traffic. So, yeah, that group is scary.
Joe Harris is going to drive another fan base nuts in the playoffs, or break their hearts. Like, the fact that they have him out there just wide open is terrifying. Were there any other teams that stood out to you after the trade deadline that you feel like have improved or have reached contender status when they weren't there before?
I think I'm interested in seeing Miami with Oladipo. I would say I'm a skeptic of Oladipo at this point after the injury he suffered. Like, he's been really up and down in the time that he's played since. But, you know, he's another athletic guy who can defend, guy who can initiate. And as we were talking about with the Cavs earlier in the podcast, anytime you can put more initiators on the floor that are going to just stretch defenses out and punish you if they get good matchups, like, I'm always interested in teams like that. And they can, look, we saw it in the playoffs last year with Bam at center. they can just switch everything and they can play all kinds of hybrid defenses. They can really lean on their zone. Jimmy Butler is a guy that, you know, I kind of make fun of him for some of his tendencies, but you know, he's a dog for lack of a better term. And the guy shows up in big moments. So I'm interested to see them. I think Boston has not been quite good enough this year to really
me either,
you know, worry about them. They're not
taking the leap.
Yeah, I just and again, they're like extremely. It's like dollar store Brooklyn, where they have, you know, some great perimeter talent, but they have like, if the Sixers are matched up against them, Embiid might go for like 40 a game. He went for 30 a game against them last year, and they were a better version of the team they are this year. So
yeah, you know,
I'm so disinterested in Miami, and I'm gonna pull one right from the Miami Heat fan base here with the Camby give, because that's how I feel about this about this Heat team. I mean, how long do we need to see the fraudulent bubble 3-point numbers before we just believe them?
Yeah,
because I just didn't. It felt fluky while they were doing it. It felt weird while they were doing it. I feel like we just all agreed that it wasn't fluky, and I don't know why. Because
the Clippers got fooled by it too. They think Bubble Rondo hitting threes is a thing that's that's worth trading multiple picks for. To me,
like, I think Miami is a good team. I believe their regular season pace last year was like for 47 wins. I'm like, yeah, that seems right. Mm-hmm. Like, that felt right to me. And like, I don't see like this like nascent 57 win team. I know Bam is taking a leap, but Jimmy's just going to get older. Justin and I both were like really wanted them to trade for Lowry because we didn't think they were going to be contenders after, and we were very confident that that was just going to cap them.
Yeah,
because they were going to give away all their kids for a 35-year-old to make the conference finals, maybe.
Plus, there was a lot of reporting that Drummond would be going to Toronto as the third team in the deal. So
that has nothing to do with that. That has nothing.
Well,
to
listen,
do with it.
Here's what I would say about Miami. I saw the Jimmy Butler act up close, and you know, there are some guys that seem to know how to play at a high level in the regular season, but still, let's say, selectively give a damn during the mm-hmm. regular season. I think Jimmy Butler, I saw that firsthand. Like, there was a switch as soon as they got into the playoffs that guy was just a total, and he was really good at points during that regular season he spent in Philly, but they hit the playoffs and that guy just was like on a totally different level.
He's a 16 game player, as Draymond likes to say. There's no denying that.
Yeah. Again, I would not want to play the Heat if I were a contender. I just don't see it. Even with Oladipo, like I didn't feel like they were an Oladipo away from true contender status by any means. Like I think it's a perfectly fine move. I just don't understand. I'm not in any rush to fall over myself to congratulate that team for what they did this. Like, yeah, they didn't give up much, but they did give up, you know, their starting power forward, who was really, really helpful for them all year.
Don't worry, they will congratulate themselves enough that they will do that
Eat
enough.
Culture, buddy.
Yeah, they will
Eat
do that enough
culture.
For the collective NBA universe. But before we wrap this thing up, Kyle, one thing I want to get. I want your predictions on who is going to be in each conference finals and the NBA finals. I want to go a little longer.
Can I play too?
Yeah, we're all going to give our takes.
That's nice.
I asked him first. Yeah, enough with you.
I was just asking.
Enough with
you. Okay. So this is obviously going to be pending whatever the standings are, because I think
you
it's
couch
a lot
it.
Of
Don't
no no
you
no.
Couch
I'm,
it.
Listen, I'm going to give you my picks with the caveat that I just gave. I think it's going to be Sixers Nets in the conference finals, and I think it's going to be, let's say, Lakers Nuggets. I'm going to be kind of boring.
I love that Nuggets team now, man. They make so much sense with Gordon.
I got to say, like, you know, coming being on the from the Philly perspective, there's obviously a lot of, I think it's like misplaced Jokic hate, because people on Twitter are like, well, they constantly compare.
Mm-hmm. I remember the Dame Kyrie wars.
Yeah, I was going to say Kyrie John Wall. Kyrie John Wall sticks out to me.
So you guys get it. It's whenever you have a good player at a certain position, they inevitably get compared to other elite players at the position. So there's been a lot of hate from Philadelphia towards Jokic, where like, I love watching that guy play. I think he's great. And he's wholly unique. He's way different than Joel. Like, both of those guys are good at different things. They succeed in different ways. And I get, like, that's how sports works. It's very territorial. It's all about your guy. But this season has been great because it's the resurgence of the big man. Like, for a while there, until Embiid went out, basically, it was two big men at the top of the MVP list. And now it's probably, I think Jokic is probably, if not the favorite, he's right there for the MVP right now, because he's the only guy who's played at that level.
He's the only one left standing.
Yeah. Healthy for most of the season. I think it's just going to come down to whether his team wins enough games where some people feel good voting for him.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And your final spec, you obviously have Brooklyn, because you alluded to that earlier.
I wish I could pick the team I cover, because I'd love to cover a finals team. I think Brooklyn, with their full weaponry, is going to go. And again, it's boring, but I think it's Brooklyn, LeBron and Anthony Davis, or LeBron and Anthony Davis. And I expect that they'll figure it out.
I'm going to go full hipster here. And I hate to.
Oh, here
this.
We go.
I think you're getting I agree with your conference finals in the West. I think it's going to be Bucks Sixers, though, in the East. I do not trust the health of KD or AD. I'm really worried about that, as well as LeBron. Like, I just think the timelines, how rushed this season is, I think it's going to be really difficult for a lot of these guys to recover. And Philly kind of has the infrastructure to work Joel back a little more gradually once he is back.
Joel is also young.
Yeah, that's a significant factor as well. But I think it's going to be a Nuggets Sixers finals. And
you are such a hipster.
I am such a hipster. I don't care. I normally don't go this route, but I'm going this route today. And I'm really looking forward to that matchup, especially if Jokic does get an MVP, because I think the storylines would be out of control. And that would be a lot of damn fun. That'd be so much fun.
That would be a very, very fun outcome. I think I'm going to go. I like Philly, Brooklyn too in the East, and I think Brooklyn's going to come out. I just think their talent level is bananas. Like, I feel like there is already so many narrative swings where it was like the pro Bron camp and the anti Bron camp have already like taken these annoying swings back and forth at each other to try to raise up the Nets as a threat and then denigrate them down. So if LeBron wins, they don't. Like, it's just this horrible little
trying to have it both ways. It's terrible.
It's this terrible battle that we get to just like sit on the sidelines of. I think their talent level is bananas. I think we're gonna look back at them, even knowing that Blake and LaMarcus are closer to washed than they are to what they used to be, and go, holy crap, like, this team is perhaps the best offensive talent ever, maybe.
I have been prone to overthinking it in the past, and I am more than willing to accept the possibility that I'm doing this here.
It is wild that you have built an entire podcast belief system out of defenses for nerds, and yet you do not have this team in the final. This team reminds me so much of like the 2017 Cavs that just had like just ungodly firepower, and nobody could hang with them except perhaps the greatest team ever assembled in the 2017 Warriors. And so I got Brooklyn coming out of the East. I love Nuggets Lakers coming out of the West, with one big caveat. LeBron, last time LeBron had a major injury, he did not look good when he came back from it. And he is at the
That's
age.
That's a very fair point.
He is in the age bracket that makes me nervous about that,
That was my reasoning, right?
He's got a real ramp up that he's going to have to do. And the team might need him to be good right away, just in terms of the seeding race. So I'm definitely worried about his recovery, but I'm going to do the long bet on his general health and freakishness. I will say this. I can't quite quit the Clippers. I don't like them. I don't enjoy them, but I remember, I just feel like
Kawhi's already shopping for his next team. You know him.
He just bought like a $500 million house in LA. Yeah. No. I don't know, man. I just got a weird vibe that like we all are just going to clown them all year, and then we're going to realize like, oh no, they're still really, really, really good, and I think they can beat anybody. I think it's the finals appearance that nobody wants to see. nobody wants to see,
including Sixers fans, if the Sixers somehow make it there, because if they have to play Kawhi in the finals again, in the finals, like the playoffs at all, some real PTSD.
So like, I don't know. I just feel like everyone's just a little too quick to write them off, even though I would very much not root against them. But I'm gonna stick with Lakers, Nuggets, and but just I don't think we should be forgetting about this Clippers team.
I do got love for Ty Lue, so I'll
and that's the other thing, is that's the only reason I'll be happy for them.
Yeah,
just because I love Ty,
the only likable person on that in that organization.
Yeah, well, they've shipped off everyone else.
Yeah, that's a good point. Kyle, thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate you joining us. Before we go, do you have anything that you'd like to plug for our audience right now?
No, just follow my work at the Philly Voice, and you can follow me on Twitter at Kyle Newbeck. Otherwise, you know, hope everybody is staying safe and healthy at home right now.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate your time and joining us on the podcast here. I really appreciate our listeners as well. If you are watching live on YouTube, make sure you like and subscribe. And if you're listening on the podcast, do what you should always be doing to any podcast you love and want to support. Leave that rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and help cook those books. If you want to be part of the Chase Downs exclusive Discord chat, you can send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. However you choose to support us, we really do appreciate it. Make sure you guys are staying safe out there, and until next time, go Cavs.